From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Michael Mann is the distinguished professor and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. In 1998, Mann and two other colleagues published a paper in the journal Nature that discussed the Northern Hemisphere's average temperature over the past 1,000 years.
The graph used to illustrate their findings was shaped roughly like a hockey stick, showing first a slight but steady decline in average temperature from the year 1000 until around 1900, when the average temperature begins to rise at a rate never seen before.
This sudden rise becomes the blade of the stick and compelling evidence that man is contributing to the planet's rising temperature through the burning of carbon and the introduction of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Michael Mann and his hockey stick graph have had quite a long, strange trip since 1998, through the halls of academia, the studios of radio and TV, and finally, down the rabbit hole to Washington, D.C.
That's right. He chronicles these adventures and the challenges he has faced from climate change deniers in his most recent book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. We'll speak with Michael Mann in the first part of the show.
And then in the second half of the show, we'll talk about the latest news and views on honeybees. Doug Fryer is an experienced local beekeeper at Copper Moose Farm and other locations, and he's also a honey connoisseur. He'll have a few different kinds of honey to show us in the studio today, and we'll share that with you via Facebook.
Yeah, we'll share with us some updates on the health of his honeybees and others nationwide, particularly in light of recent research findings regarding the influence of pesticides on colony collapse disorder.
You'll hear all that and more on today's show. You are listening to This Green Earth on KPCW Radio. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, the weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson across the table. Michael Mann is the distinguished professor and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. In 1998, Mann and two other colleagues published a paper in the journal Nature that discussed the Northern Hemisphere's average temperature over the past 1,000 years. Simple enough, right? But Mann and his chart, as now we were saying in introduction, have had quite a strange trip since 1998, the publishing of the paper, and like we say, through the halls of academia, the studios of radio and TV, and finally down the rabbit hole into the Kabuki Theater, that is Washington, D.C. Michael will help us explain all of that. He joins us on the phone from his offices at Penn State University. Michael, thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Hey, let's start with just basically some background on the work that you did, which resulted in this chart. As we say, it was basically an attempt to define the average temperature of the northern hemisphere, using what's called climate proxy data. Can you explain what that is?
Sure thing. So, yeah, we were seeking to reconstruct temperatures as far back as we could go. There's far more evidence, far more data for the northern hemisphere. So we focused on the northern hemisphere, and we resorted to using what are known as climate proxy data, as you allude to, things like tree rings and corals, ice cores, ocean sediment. And the reason we make use of these sorts of data is that there's only a relatively brief period of about 100 years back in time where we have widespread thermometer measurement, where we can directly estimate the temperature of the Earth mm-hmm. and how it has varied. To go farther back than that, we have to turn to these alternative sources of information, these so-called proxy data. And by doing so, we can place modern warming in a long-term context, because we know the globe has warmed a little less than a degree Celsius, about a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the past century. The question arises, how unusual is that warming? Is there any precedent for it as far back as we can go in time? And when we published this reconstruction, what we showed was that the recent warming really doesn't have any precedent as far back as we can go. We have seen levels of warmth that the Earth has not seen for at least 1,000 years now, and probably longer. And the shape of the curve takes us, if you think about, 1,000 years ago, conditions being relatively warm, and then declining in subsequent centuries into the depths of the Little Ice Age, right. the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, followed by the abrupt warming during the Industrial Revolution. If you use your imagination, that curve looks sort of like a hockey stick.
Right.
Hence the name. It was featured. This curve was featured in the summary for policymakers of the third assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The summary for policymakers is the part of the report that's most widely read by policymakers and by the lay public. And so this curve quickly became an icon in the larger debate over human-caused climate change. And because of that, I found myself involuntarily in the center of that larger debate. And indeed, I tell my experiences, as a scientist who found himself in the center of this, fractious debate over right. human-caused climate change in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Right.
So what year was this graph published? And had nobody looked at this before? Was this the first time this data came out? Were you expecting this kind of prominence and significance of your research?
Yeah, so, all science really is incremental, with very few exceptions. And so, our work built on work of other scientists in particular, we would not have been able to do this work if it were not for the efforts of hundreds, if not thousands, of scientists who have obtained these various records around the globe, who have gone to distant locations to core ice or to measure tree growth or to recover these coral records from the tropical oceans. So there's really a lot of work and effort that has gone into assembling this widespread database of climate proxy data. And there had been some earlier attempts to synthesize those data into an estimate of the northern hemisphere temperature. But those previous estimates weren't quite as rigorous in terms of estimating, for example, the uncertainties in the reconstruction, so we can ask questions, is the recent warming unprecedented, taking into account the uncertainties that get larger as you go back in time. And our reconstruction was the first to really provide quantitative estimates of uncertainty and to go back that far and to synthesize a record from so many different sources of information.
So how was the paper at that time received by your peers?
Well, the work was widely regarded as far as the feedback that I got from colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
I think they appreciated the hard work that goes into synthesizing these sorts of climate reconstructions. It was well received. As always happens in science, there's give and take. Other scientists try to improve on your work. They may critique aspects of that work, and that's all part of the give and take of science.
Right.
That's the sort of interaction within the scientific community that helps lead science forward. And so, now, a decade and a half later, there are literally dozens of these sorts of reconstructions. I sometimes say there's no longer a hockey stick, there's a hockey league.
Right.
Because there are so many of these reconstructions using different methods, different data, and all of them do come to the same conclusion that the recent warmth really is unprecedented as far back as we can go. So this decade and a half old study has stood up quite well against the scrutiny of our peers, and again, that give and take, and that inexorable sort of advance forward that science always displays.
Well, this sudden rise in average temperature occurs somewhere around the Industrial Revolution, and that's the suggestion that burning carbon, fossil fuels, et cetera, is introducing large amounts of carbon, greenhouse gases, which contributes to the greenhouse gas effect. We're at around 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now, on average, not just a spike anymore. I think we covered that spike a
few years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it looks like we're going to be heading to an average concentration of 400 parts per million.
Right.
Here's one kind of pushback I get when I talk to people: the number, the concentration. It's 400 parts per million. It's so small. How can that make a difference? Can you help me help our listeners respond to that argument?
Sure. I mean, CO2 is a very potent greenhouse gas. The cyanide will kill us in concentrations much lower than that because it's a very potent poison. And CO2 is a very potent greenhouse gas. A single CO2 molecule is extremely effective in absorbing the heat that the Earth is trying to send out to space to cool off as it's being heated by the sun, the greenhouse effect. And so, when you look at the levels that we've reached now, as you say, we've crossed the 400 parts per million threshold this past 2 years. The geological evidence and the ice core evidence tells us that those levels are probably higher than anything the Earth has seen in millions of years. Millions of years. So nature has not produced CO2 levels that high on its own in millions of years. We have built up these levels, these concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere on a time scale of literally just a century or two.
Right.
And so what we're talking about is an unprecedented change in the composition of the atmosphere and the climate.
So going back to you had your paper or papers, because it was updated again, I think, in 1999, or peer-reviewed, and that's what, like you say, that's what happens in the science
sure.
discipline. But there's, of course, there is the court of public opinion, which has put you and your colleagues on trial this past, since 1998, I guess. It's been
right.
a continuous
yeah.
effort. And that's what really your book chronicles. And it's amazing. Some of the stories and some of the for lack of a better term, some of the abuse you've had to take, you and
right.
your colleagues have had to take from people who aren't climate scientists. Who are these deniers that are out there, and what is some of the information they've been fomenting?
So you're absolutely right. There is this good faith give and take that science, that's essential in science. It's real skepticism. It's, holding each other to the highest levels of proof,
right.
of demonstration, of scrutinizing work, finding flaws, looking for flaws. That's the self-correcting machinery that keeps science advancing forward, and that's a healthy thing in science and should always be encouraged, and all good scientists should be true skeptics. Unfortunately, in today's world, we have what I call pseudo-skeptics or contrarians or flat-out deniers, those who are denying basic science. And in many cases, they've got an agenda. They've got a hidden agenda. They're not simply interested in scientific truth. They may be tied in some way or another to vested interests, fossil fuel interests, who have a stake in this, right? You know, understandably, the fossil fuel industry does not want to see us transition away from our addiction to fossil fuels, as George W. Bush once said.
Right.
In many cases, unfortunately, they've used their wealth and power to try to poison, really, the public discourse over this issue by creating front groups whose sole purpose is to try to discredit the science of climate change by paying some scientists with impressive credentials to act as paid advocates for them, to attack their fellow scientists, to attack the science of climate change. It's really straight out of the tobacco playbook. It's what the tobacco industry did decades ago, and now we see it in the fossil fuel industry, where many of the same individuals who were advocating against the health concerns of tobacco products decades ago are today being paid by the fossil fuel industry to sow doubt about the science of climate change. And in my view, it's really quite a villainous action to try to thwart any effort by society to deal with what may be the single greatest challenge that we face, finding a way to prevent truly dangerous and irreversible climate change from taking place.
Right.
There's a worthy debate to be had about what policies that we should put in place to deal with this problem, but there can no longer be a worthy debate about whether the problem exists or whether it poses risks to us.
So after years of kind of dealing with this, varying public opinion and climate deniers and things along those lines, you find yourself in Washington testifying in front of Congress. And tell us a little bit about how you got there and your role.
Sure. So I testified in the U.S. Senate back in, I believe it was 2003, summer of 2003, back when James Inhofe, the senior senator from Oklahoma, which incidentally became the hottest state ever a couple years ago, and it broke all records for how hot any state has ever been.
Right.
Interesting coincidence.
Right.
Yes, and in that same year, James Inhofe was continuing to proclaim, climate change as the single greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. In fact, he had been invited to be the keynote the speaker at the annual conference of the Heartland Institute. This is a fossil fuel-funded front group that has tried to discredit the science of climate change, and they have sort of a pseudo-conference. It looks like a scientific conference, but it's just a PR event. Every year, James Inhofe was selected to be their keynote speaker, and he had to back out at the last minute because he had gotten ill swimming in a lake back in Oklahoma that was suffering from an algal bloom as a result of the unprecedented heat and drought that Oklahoma was experiencing that summer. So it gives you some idea of some of the irony in climate change denial. And James Inhofe is probably, perhaps the most prominent climate change denier in the U.S. Congress. He held a hearing back in 2003 that I testified at, and it was me with two climate change contrarians on either side of me testifying to the Senate. My first experience. It was a bit of, kabuki theater, to use that term again.
Yeah.
It was theater, really, rather than substance, grandstanding. James Inhofe had used his authority as the chair of that committee to try to do the bidding of the special interests who fund his campaigns,
right,
fossil fuel interests, and that was not the last such experience. In 2006, I testified in a House committee hearing chaired by Joe Barton. Now, some of you may remember Joe Barton. He was the congressman who wanted to apologize to BP,
right,
on the part of the administration, apologized to BP for them having dumped a whole lot of oil into our Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
That may be, you know, the point at which Joe Barton became somewhat of a household name. But 5 years before that, in 2005, when he was the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee, chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee
right.
in Congress. He used, or many would say, abused his authority as the chair of that committee to try to issue a subpoena to demand all of my personal emails, presumably to look for something, you know, that they could use to discredit the hockey stick, perhaps by discrediting me personally.
Right.
And that led to a fairly fractious debate. You had Republicans like Sherwood Bullard, the former chair of the House Science Committee. You had John McCain coming out and blasting their fellow Republican Joe Barton for engaging essentially in modern-day McCarthyism. And I ended up testifying in Congress in relation to that particular event.
Right.
And, you know, the story goes on. A few years later, Ken Cuccinelli, the Tea Party Republican Attorney General of Virginia, tried to do the same thing, tried to use his authority, or again, abuse his authority as Attorney General of Virginia to issue a subpoena demanding all my personal emails from the time I was at the University of Virginia, my emails with 39 different climate scientists around the world. And, you know, it might not surprise you to learn that Ken Cuccinelli, too, was heavily funded by fossil fuel interests. So it's needless to say, I've had a number of interesting experiences at the center of this debate, and it has really opened my eyes to, you know, what is, I think, a very intellectually bankrupt and really quite dangerous game.
Right.
Where high-level politicians continue to abuse their power and authority to try to poison this discussion
right.
about climate change and what to do about it.
Well, we only got a minute. We know you got to run in a minute, but through all this, and we know that it's going to continue, you remain hopeful. Can you give us a quick sketch why you remain hopeful?
Sure. I do remain hopeful. I'll tell you, I was just in Salt Lake City a week ago, and I know the mayor of Salt Lake City is engaged in efforts to encourage sustainability, to lower that city's carbon footprint. And if you look around the country, there are many cities, municipalities, and even some states now that are banding together and saying, look, in the absence of congressional authority, in the absence of a congressional bill, a climate change bill, which we may not see for some years now, because after all, our House of Representatives right now is run by Republicans who unfortunately don't even accept that climate change is real. So
right.
in that atmosphere, we're unlikely to see comprehensive climate legislation come out of the House of Representatives. And, you know, in the absence of, a climate bill, some people might look at that and say, and see reason to be pessimistic. On the other hand, there is a lot of action taking place at the local level, at the state level, and we may see a solution from the ground up. We may see efforts to control carbon emissions. In the case of California, Washington, and Oregon have now banded together to institute a carbon tradable emissions scheme to limit carbon emissions. And the president, the executive branch, has taken some fairly dramatic actions, for example, these new standards for coal-fired power plants, to also try to deal with this problem in that way. So,
yeah.
we're seeing a lot of activity now, a lot of action taking place, and one of the things that encourages me the most is the fact that there are increasingly Republicans who are coming out and saying, look, we cannot be the party of anti-science.
Right.
We have to embrace science. And we have to embrace what it truly means to be conservative, right? If you're a conservative, you ought to want to conserve the environment, conserve the planet. And there are an increasing number of fairly prominent Republicans who are coming out and saying, look, let's stop this charade about whether climate change exists or not. Let's have the worthy debate about what to do about it. And let's bring our principles to the table. Let's see if we can find, you know, free market-driven solutions to pricing carbon. And I think that's great. I think that's the discussion that we need to have.
I agree. And we've had ex-Congressman Bob Inglis on the show talking about that.
You know, and he's leading that effort. And, you know, he's not just a Republican. He's a conservative Republican.
Oh, he's very conservative.
But he recognizes that there's nothing inconsistent between being a conservative Republican and wanting to, you know, maintain the earth.
So as we wrap up here, where can, you know, if our listeners want to learn more about what you're doing or, you know, find your book, where can they learn more?
Oh, great. Thanks. Yeah, so, you know, certainly folks, if they have the opportunity, should check out my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. It's got a guest foreword by Bill Nye, the science guy.
Right.
One of our favorites.
Yeah, he's a good friend and he's a hero of mine. And in addition to that, I'm pretty active in social media. Folks can follow me at Twitter, Michael E. Mann at Twitter. I believe that it's, you know, the responsibility of scientists in this field to engage with the public and to do our best to communicate in, you know, simple terms what the risks are and what the options are. And that's, you know, that's what I spend a lot of time trying to do these days.
Well, that's what Nell and I think we try to do here on This Green
Absolutely.
Earth.
Absolutely.
So Michael Mann, he's the Distinguished Professor and Director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. So much more to talk about. Hope we do get a chance to chat with you in the future, Michael. But thanks again. We'll be in touch.
You.
Thanks. Hey, let's take a little break for some underwriters. As always, bottom of the hour, it's This Green Earth. We'll be back with Doug Fryer,
honey expert.
We'll get to that.
Beekeeper extraordinaire.
Stay tuned.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Hi, this is John with Park City Nursery.
And this is Kay with the Park City Tree Ranch.
Supporting KPCW since 1983.
Between the two locations, we carry a variety of products to help your yard and garden flourish, including living plants, yard art, seeds, bark, compost, and organic products. Park City Nursery. We know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power WattSmart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, WattSmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and I'm here in the studio, of course, with Chris Jerniak across the board. And also in the studio with us this morning is Doug Fryer. He is an experienced beekeeper here in Summit County. He has some hives at Copper Moose Farm, and he's here to talk with us about some of the issues with the honeybee population in general, and also some of what's going on locally. So, Doug, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
That's
and
right.
I brought treats.
Good.
As usual, Doug has brought some great visuals for the radio. Not always a great match.
Always a fine idea.
Well, do a good job, Doug, and we'll...
But we'll be posting, you know, some photos on Facebook so you can see these different types of honey that we'll be talking about on the air.
So let's start. It's May. How long have the bees been out working?
Those colonies that overwintered that survive through the winter, which is unique with honeybees, are out and have been out. As soon as it's warm, they'll get out. Any temperature over 45 plus degrees, they'll be out flying. Lower than that, they kind of just cluster together in the hive itself and shiver and stay warm, eat honey.
Right, they spend the winter.
Right, they
overwinter. Doesn't sound like a bad life.
No.
But they spent the winter just all
yeah, they cluster.
Up
that's the one thing that's unique heat. With honeybees is they will overwinter in a large colony, a superorganism. They all work together for the one goal, you know, which is essentially storing energy.
And the
for
bees
the
that are on the outside of the hive,
yeah, they're cold.
They're cold, but then they work.
And then
the
they rotate
inside.
In. Yeah,
so
they
if
all
you had
kind
a
of get a chance.
Photograph.
Yeah, so
it, you'd see the hive probably
miserable
say,
for everyone.
Yeah, they spread. They all they share the misery.
Yeah,
and that's how they survive.
Yeah. And they're essentially a Mediterranean. They evolved in the Mediterranean, Greece, east part of southern Europe, kind of in the Crimea area. So they're still used to that kind of Mediterranean.
And of course, they're so successful because they're about 98% female, right?
Right, because they can. That's probably one big reason.
They're all
yeah. – Everything's sharing, everything.
They're very
it's
few
all,
males.
It is, yeah, there's very few males. Their male population goes up in the summertime.
Right.
And then it's pretty much non-existent in the winter. They
because
physically
there's no use for
kick
them
out. Yeah, they physically kick the males out
about
in,
it. They,
in
the
October.
Fall, they get booted out
yeah,
of the hive.
Yeah, you'll see them struggling, pushing them straight out of the hive in the
and then they
in
freeze.
The fall. And then they freeze.
Oh, that's brutal. It's, Chris's face is just it's, outraged well, right now.
But,
yeah.
But they deserve it because, like you've described, they don't do anything.
They don't do much. They the males that are in the hive, the queen can control which type of egg she lays, fertilized or unfertilized. Unfertilized become the males. She will taper that based on the needs of the colony. Again, it's a superorganism, and they all kind of work together. And in all honesty, the workers in the hive are pushing the queen around. She's essentially she's the pulse of that hive, but she's not really in charge. So a queen is kind of a misnomer and a name. She responds to what the workers are essentially telling her. They'll push her around, keeping her moving to lay eggs. They feed her. They clean her. She puts out a pheromone that keeps the hive humming along, so to speak, but that just essentially tells the workers eggs are being laid, things are happening. If that pheromone tapers off as she gets older and her egg-laying ability also tapers off, they will starve her. They'll just give up on her.
Oh.
They'll take one of the eggs that she laid, feed it a specialized diet to create a new queen, and then just abandon her.
This is a real Game of Thrones
yeah,
type
I know
of
it
thing
is.
Going on.
When they swarm, when the hive reaches a population point where they can essentially split, they'll just stop feeding the older queen. She'll produce a couple more eggs. They make those into queens. Then they force her out of the hive to go fly with them, and away they go to form another colony. But back to the drones, the males are essentially born in the summer. They fly out of the hive during the daytime and congregate with other drones from other hives in what they essentially call drone congregation areas. It's also, I think, a misnomer for a bar.
And right.
Yeah.
They look
all
for,
the guys hanging
yeah,
out.
Yeah, all the guys hang out and they fly around. They spend their days there looking for unmated queens to fly by, and they will chaser.
No nectar collection.
No they come back to the hive each night and are fed and are cleaned and they sleep and then they head out again the next day. Who doesn't want to spend their day looking for unmated queens?
Well, yeah,
and,
but, you know.
then you get
then the fall arrives.
Then the fall comes around and it's time to pay up.
So what do you do to keep these Mediterranean, you know, insects alive over a winter in Park City?
In Park City, of course, we have a shortened season almost by 3 weeks, a month from even Salt Lake Valley. So it's a little more difficult. You have to leave them more honey because that's their food source that they've stored up for the winter. So you essentially leave a lot of honey. I only harvest honey. I can sometimes take some in the fall, in the summer, when they have time to recover. Most of the honey harvesting that I do is done in the spring when they're – like this time of year. I'm going to go check a hive when we're done with the show here to pull some honey off it because they've overwintered well enough. They're already rebuilding their stores, and now I can safely take some off.
Without
and that's
skin.
The other unique part about European honeybees is they were selected because they store so much excess honey.
Got
as
it.
As opposed to others.
So how many hives do you have in this area, and where are they?
I have three currently at Copper Moose Farm. I put two new hives, first-year hives, at Bill White's new farm on 224.
All right.
Then I've got two, going to be three, in my house in Camas. And then there's a number of people that also have. There's some Pine Brook and Jeremy Ranch. You'd be surprised. There's a fair number of people around. Timberline.
Yeah.
Up in there. And it makes management a little more difficult. You have to leave a lot more honey. You need to sometimes give them a windbreak, insulation to a point.
Right.
But for the most part, they're kind of on their own.
How many hours a week are you spending managing?
In the spring, 4 to 6 maybe a week. In the summer, less than that. And in the fall, maybe back to 4. It just, yeah, in the summer, just let them do their thing. So long as the hive's set up that they can grow and do their thing, you just let them do their thing.
What kind of cues are you looking for that you maybe have an unhealthy hive?
A decreased population, what's called you'll open up the hive and look at what's called a brood pattern. So you pull out a frame or a bar with honeycomb built on it, and it's called honeycomb, but it's often more often used for raising baby bees. It's their brood nest, and you will look for what's called a brood pattern. And if it's very spotty and spread out all over the hive, you wonder what's going on. Is that do you need to replace the queen, intervene, ordering a queen, mail order, and from a person who can manipulate a hive to produce multiple queens, and they will sell you a queen. You can do that, early intervention, or you can just let them kind of do their own thing and figure it out. And they'll, you know, make a queen off that stock. You also look for storage, you know, food, how much are they putting away, what's their population like, and
okay,
lots of more technical things, insects, pests, signs of viruses.
Have you ever had a hive abandoned, colony, CCD?
I've never had anything that looked that came across with those typical hallmarks of what they call colony collapse, which is a complete abandonment of a hive. I've had ones that have died off from most likely what's called a varroa mite. Mm-hmm. Problems with the varroa mites are little essentially ticks that will bite onto the bees and just drain them of energy. And as the population of the bees themselves drop in the winter, the mite population continues to climb, and so it can be a real problem in the fall. So you look for things like that. There's a bacteria or a virus called Nosema, which shows up from time to time. It has some different telltale signs you have to look for. But essentially, it's just a numbers game. If you've got two weak hives in the fall, you've got to combine them to make one strong hive through the winter, and that's a little more trouble up here because you have such a shortened season. But
right,
yeah, I haven't ever taken mine out.
Anyone
of state
else you
or
know around here that has witnessed or observed
not
colony collapse?
Not that I've ever heard of. Huh. I've heard, you know, the usual loss numbers, 15%, even up to 20%. But we're talking low numbers.
Okay.
There are a couple of commercial beekeepers, I think, that used to have some hives, you know, 30, 40 hives in White Pine Canyon area. But I haven't seen those in the last couple of years.
And when that occurs, it's literally the bees are there one day and basically gone.
Yeah,
the next.
That's what I've read with colony collapse. That's the thing that's unique about it. A pesticide die-off, if your hive was exposed to a pesticide, you would expect to see a lot of dead bees in the hive when you open it.
Right.
The foragers have come back and now died, or brought it back to the hive and now they've died. And that weakens and eventually kills the hive. That's typical of a pesticide die-off. Viruses and bacteria, a little more slower progression. Colony collapse was unique in the fact that, you know, from what I'd read, a couple days it's fine and a couple days later it's empty.
It's a ghost.
Yeah.
It's a ghost
completely
hive.
Empty. Yeah. And
that's creepy.
That is creepy.
And scientifically, that's very difficult to reproduce. And, you know, when they've tried different things
and
to reproduce
that. Trying to understand, is it pesticide related? Is it bacterial or virus related?
And that what I've read recently in that New York Times article that you sent me, and I've read a couple, there was two things that came out this last month, was a follow-up study on neonicotide insecticides, which is a very more and more common insecticide, mm-hmm. mostly in agricultural, industrial use, but still it shows up on the shelves of nurseries, you know, to spray on ornamentals, on fruits. And it's that study showed a little less of a decline related. It didn't tie it quite. It actually kind of contradicted a previous study on the neonicotide. So it kind of leaned away from maybe these neonicotides. And then the other study showing bee colony numbers going up this year. and the colony collapse in the field hasn't been documented for about 3 years in that classic form that they've just abandoned the hive. That was the other unique thing. So it's again, now it's kind of up in the air. It's one of those waiting for confirmation, which is difficult.
Right.
I think that we've covered, you know, several of those different causes and interviewed people, and some people have been, you know, convinced, and their research shows it's the neonicotinoids, and other people think it's something else, and maybe a combination of factors. And so it does seem like
that's
a really hard
kind of leans towards. Most complicated problems have complicated answers, and there's no single smoking gun. It's not the neonicotinoids. If we get rid of neonicotinoids, we'd have no more colony collapse. It seems it's a combination. We've got bees that are shipped, you know, from the almonds. 90% of the beehives in America were in California in February for the almond orchards.
What?
They're
Wait a
so
minute. 90% of the
are shipped to California to provide pollination
just
services
for almond crop.
For almonds. Almonds are so valuable. And they're completely insect pollinated, and they blossom for, you know, 2 weeks. So everyone ships all their honeybees there because there's the Central Valley, the area that the almonds will grow, is so confined, and it makes so much money.
Okay.
So the pollination rates go up there. All of them are shipped there. They mix. You know, you get introduction of – then you have the viral or the infectious disease component because all the bees from all over the country are now – meeting together.
Really concentrated.
Spring break.
And then after that, they go their separate ways.
Yeah, then they go their separate ways. Then they go to another exclusive – there's a nutritional aspect. They're fed nothing but almonds, and they're fed nothing but cranberries, and they're fed nothing but blueberries in there. And in the middle of all that, they're picked up and moved, which is stressful.
Right.
And so you get a combination of all those things, pesticides.
Synergistic
exposures.
Effects.
Right.
If you just join us, we're speaking with Doug Fryer. He's a local beekeeper, and he is here to talk about all things honeybees and some of the issues related, challenges related to honeybee survival and neonicotinoids and their problems associated with that. Of course, if you're Bayer or Monsanto, whether you're the manufacturer of neonicotinoids, you're going to say it's the varroa mite or Nozema or something
right,
else.
Right, and that's a difficult thing because it's so hard to pin down. They have valid points. You know, even when the insecticide companies look at these studies and say, "Well, your exposure rates are way off what normally would be exposed," they're absolutely right. Sometimes. So,
well, in Europe, in Europe there is a ban right now on neonicotinoids.
In Europe, there's
an ongoing experiment. There is an absence of neonics, and we'll see.
Europe and Great Britain, especially, is very good for those type of experiments because Great Britain, being an island, is you can essentially isolate itself from viruses, bacteria, by not allowing imports of queens, of other hives, of things like that. And they don't have quite the agriculture system we do that requires shipping these bees thousands of miles.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
Got it.
That might be part of it.
Well, we have a call from a listener left a question because they would like to remain anonymous. This is a really interesting question. So this person was in New Zealand, I think, biking along abandoned railways. And there were a lot of beehives in and around marijuana plants. And he ran into one of the beekeepers who said that they were making marijuana honey. So the question is, have you ever heard of this?
Wow.
And if bees are using marijuana pollen,
I have not
would the honey have a marijuana effect?
Wow. I have not heard of that. I have heard of some guys in Colorado that were feeding marijuana to pork, to pigs, to make pot bacon, which...
Does that work?
I don't think it matters if it works.
It'll sell. Yeah, it'll sell.
You're right. Like, so maybe this is the new industry for California.
That could be.
Get the hives set up in the growing fields, I guess.
Well, bees aren't particular when they're flying. Or maybe they are particular.
They are to a point. They follow a blossom. Apples are out right now, and so you'll see one or two bees on an apple tree now, and then you'll see tomorrow 12, you know, or hundreds or thousands, because they communicate. When they find a nectar source, they're able to fly back to the hive and communicate in a very complicated communication system that will bring the other bees to that spot.
Speaking of using different sources to make the honey, let's talk about the different honeys that we have in the studio here. Like, we've all seen different colors of honey in the store, but what makes that happen? So there's kind of like a dark brownish one,
yeah,
one
so
that's
the,
bright
the
yellow.
Colors are usually are directly related to the nectar source and the sugar content of that nectar source. Some plants put out a very concentrated sweet nectar. Some put a very thin nectar. And the nectar is essentially just a bribe that the plant has evolved to lure an insect to be the pollination part of it, to take pollen from one part of the flower to another tree, hopefully, and you get the cross-pollination that way. But the color itself is just related to the sugar content. It does affect the flavor typically, kind of like wines. You'll find a darker color has a much stronger, bolder taste to it, almost more molasses. Cooked raisins is one flavor that I've heard people mention. Lighter honeys can be light in color and in thickness. They can be thick in viscosity but very light in color. It really depends. And it's these two, I know we're on the radio and we're doing visual aids, are from the same hive just during different seasons.
Right. Is one more nutritious than the other, a lighter?
I don't know.
If I see a darker hunter, am I?
I don't know if you'd have, it would depend on a chemical analysis of the sugar contents probably. As far, I bet it would be negligible. But flavor-wise, I know there's a number of chefs that do pairings a lot similar to wine with cheese, and they'll add a honey type or two or three honey types to complement those cheeses and things like that. I know the guy I've met at Whole Foods is really into that. He likes these dark chestnut and Tupelo honeys.
Right.
We have an update from our caller.
Oh, boy.
He called back to the front desk with an update. He says marijuana honey worked for him.
There you go.
Okay. It doesn't surprise me.
Honey makes everything taste better, and I guess so, you know.
Well, let's talk about some things that are in honey. Before the show, we talked about the pollen that is in honey.
Right.
Some people, I thought that you want a honey that has lots of pollen in it because apparently pollen is supposed to be good for you too. But not necessarily you don't want to see a lot of
pollen. It's such a great idea that pollen is good for me. I want to eat pollen. Pollen equals allergies. If I eat local honey, my allergies will go away. And that kind of falls apart in the fact that first, you shouldn't have a lot of pollen in the honey because in a beehive where honey is stored and subsequently harvested is separate from the pollen. The pollen is used to feed the brood, the baby bees. They'll take nectar and pollen and actually ferment it into a food that they'll feed the baby bees. So it's very close to the brood nest, and the honey is up in the highest parts of the hive, which is where that's their pantry. That's their food storage for winter. So you really shouldn't have a lot of pollen in the honey in the first place. What you typically see in honey that you can see things, particulates in, it's typically coarse filtered honey that has what are called wax cappings. Mm. So that the honey is completed, they cap it much like capping a barrel with a little wax, and that gets in there. So it depends on your degree of filtration. And the other part with the allergies is the things you are typically are allergic to are wind pollinated, grass, mold, pine, aspen, things like that are wind pollinated, not insect pollinated. Insects pollinate apples, dandelions, blueberries, cranberries, things like that, which people are rarely allergic to.
Oh.
And then, taking a tablespoon of honey is a great idea, but your dose is subjective to the year, to the type, to the honey from last year is going to be completely different from this year.
Okay.
And the pollen counts will therefore be very different. So you don't get a consistency in dose. I always tell people, buy medicine for medicine, buy honey for food. Local honey is great because it is much like wine. It's going to be unique to that year. It will never be that way ever again. Next season is different.
Most importantly, it's a natural source of sugar.
Right. It's a very concentrated natural source of sugar.
Having high fructose corn syrup.
Sure.
It's a better alternative for sugar.
It can be very easily substituted in some degree.
Okay. Real quick, we only got a few minutes. So what is the real dark honey?
This is actually Tupelo honey from Tupelo flowers. This is chestnut honey. They're almost similar color, and that, again, relates to their sugar content. So honey you buy in the store is often blended with these lighter colored honeys, so it will give a consistency in color that people expect and a consistency in crystallization. These lighter honeys and wildflower honeys, local honeys, you get often crystallized very quickly because of their sugar content, as where some types of honeys, this chestnut, Tupelo, don't crystallize, if ever. And crystallization just means that. It doesn't mean it's spoiled or anything. It just means it's crystallized, and you warm it up in some lukewarm water, and it comes back into solution.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It hasn't spoiled or anything, but people for the most part think, oh, that equals spoiled, so they will what they sell in the store is a blend that has a less likelihood of crystallization.
Interesting. Okay.
Another thing that I've read is that, you know, honey can get contaminated by other fillers like corn syrup when you're buying, you know, commercial. We're not talking local honey producers, but we're talking like maybe, you know, major brands that you'd see in the store. You might not be getting 100% honey even if it says that's what's in it.
It would be almost impossible to analyze that because you would the equipment you'd have to have to analyze it is almost – it's not something –
Really?
That, because corn syrup is so molecularly close to – it's close in flavor. It's close in viscosity. It's close in color. So, yeah, certainly you could cut it with the
– And that's some countries have
done. Yeah, and I know that's been
– We'll mention names. China. They've effectively –
Right. China, don't put it in your mouth.
And one of the ways that
they ultrafiltrated their pollen out of it, and that's the fingerprint.
Right. There still is going to be some pollen in any honey, and that's what they can look for. But like I said, the way you can do that is really extensive and difficult. And
okay.
You got to trust your seller.
So the point is that try to buy local or at least try to buy honey that is – within the U.S.
Right.
Produced
and look
within
around.
The U.S.
Whenever I travel, that's one of the things I look for. And, you know, I was showing you guys got some from Vancouver, from Italy, from Florida, from here, from, you know.
Yeah.
And it's always different. It's always unique. It's going to be different every year, every season. It tastes different. It looks different. It's great.
All right. Where can people go to learn more about what you do?
I actually teach a class with the High School Leisure Learning. We do a class every winter because we want to get some people have some background before the bees arrive in the spring, April. So our third class was actually the bees arriving, put them in the hive. We'd had a couple classes before that. I've done one at the Summit County Community Gardens as well and off their website.
Okay.
We're doing one on native pollinators. We're doing a couple drop-in honeybee, just come and explore the hives, learn more about all this.
Great. So we can keep our eyes out. There will be classes occasionally throughout the year if we're interested.
Honeybees, they're not insects. They are aliens from another planet. That's
the only
way. They're just incredible creatures. Doug Fryer, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this morning and updating us on honeybees.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Let's take one last break for some underwriters. And we'll be back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to The Restore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to The Restore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's local tree care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back. To This Green Earth. We are here to wrap up another week's show. And of course, we want to thank our guest from today, climatologist Michael Mann, who spoke about his new book.
That's right. The Climate Wars. And of course, Doug Fryer, always a honeybee guy extraordinaire. But of course, we want to thank our underwriters. They include Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanities Restore,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and finally, Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.